This is the Working Drummer Podcast.
Working Drummer Podcast.
Featuring ground level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and today I'm talking with Rod Elkins. Rod is the touring drummer for rising alt-country star Tyler Childers, and although the band is now headlining internationally, Rod still lives in his small hometown of Huntington, West Virginia, where the band got its start. We would appreciate your support on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/workingdrummer, and a donation in any amount gets you access to exclusive content from our former guests. Think of this as professional development for drummers, all useful and actionable lessons for the working pro. We're populating new content regularly, and as little as $1 a month gets you access to all of it. If Patreon isn't your thing, you can also make a one-time donation through PayPal. There are links for both on our homepage at workingdrummer.net. While you're there, you can learn more about this episode and check out our archive of over 300 episodes. Also, please subscribe to Working Drummer Podcast on your platform of choice. We're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube, and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Lastly, however you listen, please leave us a rating and review. This helps new listeners find us. So we've interviewed a few drummers who live in small towns, but I think Rod represents the smallest. Huntington's population is only about 50,000, but he was born and raised there. He got a music career started there. He loves it there. And out of that scene came a relationship with a hugely talented artist that evolved into a big gig. This is a great story about learning who he is and what's important to him musically and otherwise. So let's do it. I think you'll dig Rod Elkins. To my head, I could not name a single town in West Virginia.
there's your one. Right, if you get caught in that situation,
there you go. I'm trying to flash back to like fifth grade when we had to name all the 50 state capitals.
And Charleston. Okay. Charleston's our capital.
Got it. Okay. So I'm fascinated by just the fact that you live in Huntington, West Virginia, but you're part of this band that's, you know, all over the freaking world. Before we get to Huntington, West Virginia, just talk a little bit about the gig you've been doing. Is it Tyler Childers or Childers?
Childers.
Childers. Right on. So you've been doing that for a while, yeah?
Yeah, man. He started, he's kind of from Louisa, so he started hopping around. Huntington was a big city for him, which was like, I don't know, 30 minutes, I guess, away, 40 minutes from here into Kentucky. And because we're kind of right on the border, Huntington is with Ohio and Kentucky.
Okay.
And he started coming around here, and me and James and Craig, who plays pedal steel and bass in the band, we've had a band for 10 years, you know, as a trio. Tyler started boot scooting around here, and we're just like, man, you're awesome. You need a band. he was a little reluctant at first, but we finally broke him down enough, and then been doing that 6-7 years now.
Wow.
So it all kind of originated around here, and we're all basically still here.
Wow. So he was doing like solo singer-songwriter type stuff.
Yeah, man, just him, his guitar and a bow tie, and he's killing it. He's nailing it to the wall, and we were all, you know, amazed by it. And I wanted to be a part of it immediately. I was like, I want to play drums to that.
Right.
Like,
right.
Yes.
I know, man. I know that feeling. And we were talking on a recent episode about, you know, you make all these sort of calculations, you know, professionally, or, you know, especially on social media, as far as like what gigs you're playing, what gigs you want to play. It's like, oh, this guy's got some juice on him. This guy's got a big following. She's got like a tour booked or whatever. But like, none of that, for me at least, and it sounds like for you, holds as much sway as when you see and hear someone and you're like, holy shit, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, like I was going to say, that's past all that for me with Tyler. I mean, he's my brother, mm-hmm. but it's like, and like as soon as we heard, he was playing Feathered Indians pretty early. He had that one mm-hmm. and Shake the Frost from since we met him.
Yeah.
And then like hearing those, it was like, I don't care how much money I will make
right.
or not make.
Right.
I just want to play. This is what I'm doing for a living. I don't care.
Yep. This is raw talent and I want yeah. in.
I'll sweep a damn warehouse floor if I can just do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the time.
So talk about like the journey and the evolution from, you know, this guy shows up from Kentucky and, you know, a few years later, you're in Rupp Arena or something.
Like, yeah.
Like,
man, it was like slow. It was slow and fast all at the same time. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It was basically, we just knew that that's what we were doing. And I kind of broke them down a little more in regards to, we were just kind of, us three and Tyler were kind of just playing like fun covers, like country covers, like mm-hmm. your Hank Williams, your Merles, your Waylands, drinking and, you know, just having fun. And then I was just like, we need to do your songs. And little apprehension at first, you know, he'd never really played with a band yet or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And which is, you know, we all have that feeling sometimes, but I took the notion and submitted like a electronic press kit for this festival in Cincinnati. It was the first country music festival they did called Buckle Up. And I think it went away for a few years and then it came back. Buckle Up Music Festival. And it was like Sturgill Simpson was there and he had just came out with Metamodern. That yeah. record had just came out. So it was Sturgill. It was Alabama was headlining. Marty Stewart was playing. All kinds of people. I think Jamie Lynn Spears was on it, maybe.
Wow.
And so we had like a 1 o'clock slot. And if you ask those boys, I was first time dealing with music emails. And, you know, they're talking me up about 50,000 people and all this stuff. And I was like, guys, we're playing in front of 50,000 people. Not knowing that we were on like the stage that was a mile away,
right?
You know, so we got that slot. It was kind of like a contest, battle of the bands type thing, but it was all like recorded. So we did, we went and did Feathered Indians and a song he'd written called Wailing on My Willie. And we recorded those. I sent them in. We got the slot, played it like 1 o'clock, raced across to see Sturgill. That blew our minds. And then, like, I remember us all standing in the rain watching Marty Stewart. He comes out. They're all in purple suits. He's in black rhinestones. And they just start singing, Waylon, Stop the World, Let Me Off. They just walk out, not say a word, and just stop the world and let me off.
Wow.
And I was like, this is what I'm doing for the rest of my life.
Oh, man.
Like, I want to do nothing else.
Right, right. So, like, up to that point, I mean, you'd been playing, obviously, but like, were you working another job? Were you teaching? Were you just playing exclusively like in your area?
Yeah. Yeah. I was in college. We, me and Craig, the bass player, were in college. I had just taken a little break for like 3 semesters. Money kind of ran out for a little bit and I just went back. This was 2014.
Mm-hmm.
It was when we did that festival. So up to that point, I get out of high school. I play guitar in a, like a cover band doing like VFW gigs and cool. American Legions.
Yeah, yeah.
Soul crushing 4 hour Mustang Sally's, you know?
Right.
And then, titty contests at biker bars. It was insane. It was stupid. But I lived with my parents and I made like $400 a week. So I was like, this is all right.
Right, right.
This ain't bad at
that's
all.
That's sustainable.
Yeah. And then, just doing college jazz program at the college in town. So me and Craig Berletic, the bass player in the band, the Food Stamps, we both have jazz studies degrees, performance degrees.
So do
bachelor's.
I.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
How's that working out
nice.
For you?
I mean, I think I'm doing what my degree says I'm supposed to do right now.
You mean you're playing like 20-piece fusion charts in 7/8?
Yeah. Man, I would probably throw up if I saw one of those in front of me right now. Oh, but I guess if you call it a performance degree, I guess I'm doing that.
Right.
But, yeah. And then like me, James, and Craig, the trio, we had Deadbeats and Barkers. We were playing regionally, doing stuff like that. And I taught at a local music store doing drum and guitar lessons and doing college and, you know, random restaurant gigs, like working, like serving here and there.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, you know, just trying to make as much money as I could and still have the freedom to gig. And, you know, I would go for a job interview or something and they'd be like, well, I need you, you know, some weekends. And I'm like, no, this ain't for me.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Nope. I got a gig, brother.
Yeah. Is it a day that starts with S? Yeah. Sorry. Nope.
Yeah. Sorry. No, can't do it.
So like you play this festival, and then things start happening. Like at what point does it become apparent that this band and this guy is going to be full time and you kind of bail on everything else?
It was about when Sturgill entered the mix and kind of took Tyler under his wing a little bit and showed him the ropes, and they Purgatory came out, the mm-hmm. first record. They did that with Nashville Cats and stuff like that. So that's not me playing on any of the records. That's not
right
us.
I was gonna ask, so Tyler's got 5 records out, but you're not on any of them? It's all Nashville folks?
Yeah, Purgatory and Country Squire are Nashville folks. He had the Red Barns are the High Wall band he had back in the day. He had those when we started playing with him. I guess they remastered them and did that. And Bottles and Bibles was probably like his first record he ever did. So,
and when you say Sturgill entered the mix, like did Sturgill produce some of these records? Did what role did Sturgill Simpson play in Tyler's?
Yeah, he did that. He produced those two and just kind of used his guys, and they shaped the songs and, you know, got him some distribution, you know, and helped in that regard and just kind of showed him the ropes, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and his songs and his charm and prowess took it from there.
Right, so, right.
And I mean, us as a band, we were just learning, and we learned all the songs like White House Road off Purgatory. That's probably like the 3rd or 4th version we'd ever played, you know, because it had changed 2 or 3 times by that point. And we were just learning them and getting better as players as we were doing it.
Right.
You know, they did all the work for us, which is great, because I was like, I didn't think about some of these songs like that.
And you were just learning, you were learning that stuff for the purposes of playing live and touring.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were the road dogs, you know?
Right. Right. Okay. So I have 2 questions about that process. Like when this starts happening and like, you know, Tyler is making these records in Nashville, is there part of you that's afraid that like we're gonna get left behind here? He's just gonna go to Nashville. He's gonna get a new Nashville band. It's gonna like he's gonna graduate out of us.
I mean, personally, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, I can speak for myself that I fought with that at first. I was afraid of that because I perpetually don't think I'm good enough.
Hmm.
You know, I can always be better.
Mm-hmm.
I want to always be better, and I have the anxiety that I'm not good enough, especially when I hear Milky Miles Miller on these records just nailing it to the wall, and I'm right. like, shit. But at the same time, you know, I mean, it took me a second to get over that, but I did, because I had to talk myself out of it. Tyler's different, man. He's... he's a great friend. He's family. Mm-hmm. And it's really a means to an end to get us all out there. And we learned a lot listening to them. I mean, none of us had ever had much studio time.
Yeah.
You know, as a band. So it kind of was a thing where, for me, looking at it was like, all right, use these guys to make your songs the best they can be. And then we'll learn it. And then, you know, it's just, that's how it's just going to be. That's how it's going to work out. And, you know, it's like, man, I mean, I don't think if we had to do it over again, I would probably hope we all did it the same way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think when, you know, I can totally relate to the, you know, sort of not good enough mentality or the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
But I think, like, the more I'm learning about this, you know, when, if a decision is made that, like, okay, it's going to be a different band, these guys are going to be on the record, or this band is going to go on tour, I don't think it's always that, you know, that musician isn't good enough. I think it has more to do with, you know, these are the people that the producer knows. These are the people that the producer works with and trusts and whatever. And it's not that you're not good enough. It's that he doesn't know you.
Yeah. And time is money, you right. know? So if these guys are going in there and they're going to lay it down in 2-3 days, I mean, that's what you're going to want. And since COVID happened, I've been doing a lot more sessions and a lot more like flying stuff. And I've gotten better.
Yeah, me too.
At recording and stuff like that. That's awesome. Yeah. And I've gotten better and we've all adapted. And I've gotten better at doing that. And I'm like, man, I couldn't have done that like 2-3 years ago when all this was going on. You know, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. And it's a good sort of realization. It's like, it's a little bit humbling, but it's healthy, I think, to realize that, like, you know, as much ambition as we had a few years ago, because every drummer is like, man, I want to do more sessions. I want to get into this studio. I want to blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, you actually get a bunch of session work under your belt and you're like, yeah, I probably couldn't have hacked it a few years ago. I'm still not sure I could hack it now, but at least I just have a bunch more experience now to sort of lean on. But yeah, I just had this idea that, like, yeah, I just go into a studio and play, be me.
Yeah, that's all I got to do, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so easy.
Right.
You just put a mic on it. It's fine.
Yeah. I've played plenty of stuff right the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really had to learn to, obviously, talking about anxiety and stuff with not being good enough. I do have anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, it was crippling for a second, especially right before the pandemic started. And that was affecting my playing.
Yeah.
You know, thankfully, I mean, bittersweet scenario, COVID kicked us off the road.
Right.
You know, so I'm sitting around. A, I'm drinking way too much for like a month.
Yep.
And
I learned so many cocktail recipes over COVID.
Bruh, I hurt myself. Yeah. I'm still hurting.
That was kind of my justification. It was like, well, I'm going to make a fancy cocktail. You know, I'm not just going to like pound beer or pour whiskey in a glass. Like, I'm going to put some effort into it. And then it's like, it's a sort of artisanal, you know, ritualistic kind of thing. I'm not just drinking my face off.
Exactly. It's healthy now. I put effort in it. It's healthy. But so I thought it was just kind of that, you know, and it's like, wait a minute, why don't you slow down? And then I went to the doctor, and because I was just sitting there thinking, oh, it ain't going away. You know, I'm just worried all the time. And so I finally went to the doctor. We talked about it, and thankfully we did, and got me on like a medication that kind of keeps it at bay. Mm-hmm. You know, plus like little lifestyle changes. I work out a lot more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, you know what it's like being on the road. You just get unhealthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I was
like, I came home and I was 315 pounds when we got off the road.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Insane.
Yeah. It'll wreck you, man. And especially the older you get, I think the more effort and care you've got to put into just taking care of your body, whether you're on the road or not. I was on a Reddit thread a few weeks ago, and there was this guy, he was kind of getting ready to go on his first tour. And he was just asking advice about like how to be on tour. And I was like, don't drink too much, eat eat as healthy as you can, you know, get some kind of exercise once in a while,
yeah,
and take time for yourself. Like, you don't always have to be in the front of the bus making the hang, whatever, because the road, yeah, the road is just like a fertile environment for you to feel like shit and go a little bit crazy. And if you don't take care of yourself, man, it'll happen fast.
It happens very fast, and it sneaks up on you. I mean, you want the burger in every town, you know? And it's, you know, I love Thai food. So it's like me and a couple guys like Jesse, the fiddle player in the band, you know, we go get Thai food or something, you know, and I'm shoving noodles in my body two or three times a day or something, you know, with like leftovers and just sitting on the bus, drinking beer. You know, I ain't driving.
Right.
I'll have another one.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, you know, that's, it's just bad. And then I realized that the best way to see some of these cities that we're in is jogging.
Hmm.
You know, you just take off and you just see a lot of the city you're in or wherever, whatever you're in, 2 or 3 mile radius.
Yep.
And it's like, that's perfect, especially early morning. And
yeah.
I
hate jogging with the heat of 1,000 suns. But a good alternative to that is just to rent a bike. Like, get into town, rent a bike, cruise around. My second question about, like, you know, the Nashville crew sort of recording these songs is, what did you learn about songcraft and drum part construction and just that whole aspect of your job from these Nashville guys and from Sturgill's production and the results that they came out with?
What I took away from it, and it's been kind of a recent revelation to me, is that I was unfucking everything I had learned up to that point in regards to, baby, how do I learn to play two notes as opposed to six?
Yeah.
For the entire song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to feel so good with such less, with the minimal amount of notes.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, that's not just my chops. That's not just my technique. That's my soul.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting that out. We could play Rock Beat Number One together and it's going to sound different because we feel different.
Yeah.
You know, and that's been a recent revelation where I'm just like, oh man, it's only 20% of the notes I choose. It's like 70 to 80% of how I feel and how I want it to feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my intention, because I can play the same beat on like 5 songs, but it's going to feel different 5 different ways.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as the emotion of the song dictates. I mean, it's lyrics, man. You got to stay out of the way.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and I'm a foundation. You build your house on me.
Right.
You know?
Right. And, you know, I mean, you mentioned lyrics. Like, I feel like, you know, lyrical content is just paramount to how you're going to interpret one of those 5 ways. Like, you know, if you take Rock Beat Number One, you know, that lyrical content is going to determine so much of how you interpret just your basic time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's, I had to get out of my head about that, where it's like, oh my God, I've played the same beat 3 songs in a row. Like,
yeah.
It's like, it's fine. You know, because it works for 3 songs. It just so happens they're in a row on the set. And, you know, like with the lyrical content and stuff like that, if it's a sad song, I can play it sad. If it's a upbeat, you know, funky jam, I can play it upbeat and funky.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a good, and it's just emphasis.
That's a good reminder for me, because, like, you know, when constructing set lists, you know, I think singers and guitarists and other musicians are – you know, they're thinking about, what the key is it major or minor, all that. I'm always thinking about, like, what's the groove, what's the tempo. And I get bent out of shape if, like you said, there's two or three or four songs in a row that are just like same groove, same tempo.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I mean, that's a challenge for me to find a difference, like find a way to make those songs that are same groove, same tempo, just feel different somehow.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sometimes it's as easy as, all right, I'm going to be a little lazy with my hi-hat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm just going to let it float as opposed to strict time.
Right.
Like, I'm just going to let it lay there and I'm going to put that on autopilot for a second and really focus on how I'm hitting my 2 and 4,
mm-hmm.
you know, or let me put a little ghost note here, a little ghost note there. Maybe the kick pattern's just a little different, but your hands are the same. So it's like really channeling the emotion of that song into your hands and feet is, I think, what makes a great drummer, like really, and not shoving 10 pounds of notes into a 9-pound bag.
You know? Right, right. You know, it's funny, like, even drummers that we consider to be, like, really busy and guys that get away with it, I'm thinking of Carter Beauford right now because I recently played a gig with a Dave Matthews cover band, which I fucking love. I will make no apologies for.
Fucking, hey, dude.
Fucking come at me. I love it. but
I love Rio by Duran Duran right now. So. I think that song kicks ass.
There's a reason it's still around, man.
Exactly.
But I'm listening to all these Dave Matthews songs. I'm learning them. And you know, I've been aping Carter's shit since I was 15.
Totally.
But especially when it comes to fills, and especially when it comes to, you know, a chance to do a solo over a tune or something, you know, like my idea of Carter's notiest shit is still more notey than he actually is. Right.
Yeah.
Like, he's busy for sure, but like I listen to Carter on a record and then I listen to myself doing my Carter impression and it's like, wow, I'm way busier than he actually is.
Yeah.
So like
yeah,
even when we have license to just like pull out all the stops, it seems like we overdo it, or I do at least.
I think it's pretty mutual, man. I feel the same way sometimes because I think it's a lot of, for me, it's a lot of anxiety. Like, am I doing this right?
Yeah.
You know, totally. is this how he was doing it? Is that imposter syndrome kind of thing you're talking about where it's like, did I learn this correctly?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not him. You know, these are like thoughts I have.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not as good as Steve Gadd, you know, but it's like, I want to play like him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but it's like, yeah. And like picking the right notes and playing less notes. And the guys in the band, when they hear this, they'll be like, yep, you brought up One Trick Pony again. I urge you to listen to One Trick Pony by Paul Simon.
Yeah.
It's the record's called One Trick Pony, but the song, the title track's One Trick Pony. And I swear to God, Steve Gadd's barely playing, but yeah. It is all the perfect note. It's all the perfect note choices in the world.
Is that the record that 50 Ways is on?
No, okay. This was a soundtrack to, in my honest opinion, a very C-minus movie from like 1980.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Steve Gadd, it's got Cornell Dupree on it, playing guitar. Shit, who's the keyboard player?
Is it the Stuff piano? Guys?
Basically, uh-huh. Yeah, and it's got, who was the bass player in King Crimson? Bald guy mustache. I thought I'd never. Oh, Tony Levin.
Tony Levin. Yeah,
yeah. 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 Tony Levin's playing bass.
Wow.
And Richard T's on keys.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically the Stuff Guys with Tony Levin and Paul Simon.
Wow. Okay.
And yeah. Gadd. And that whole record is so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I swear, man.
But that song in particular is. He makes quarter notes sound so good.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just the king. He's the fucking champion. And I like, no matter who I talk to, Steve Gadd is coming up in every single interview. It does not matter he's just like ubiquitous in everyone's mind, in the back of every, like, no matter what style of music people are playing, no matter what their background is, everybody just wants to sound like fucking Gadd.
On April 27th, the Percussive Arts Society Tennessee chapter will present their annual Tennessee Day of Percussion event, hosted by Brian Fullen at Trevecca Nazarene University in Nashville, Tennessee, and is open to all drummers and enthusiasts. This incredible event features solo competitions in drum set, concert snare drum, and mallet keyboard. Online registration is now open to everyone who wants to participate. Visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register for this event, the competitions, or to register your percussion ensemble for the showcase. Grand prizes will be awarded to the contest winners, with door prizes raffled throughout the day. Sponsors include Yamaha, Zildjian, Remo, Innovative Percussion, Ludwig, Sabian, and many more. There will be clinics and performances throughout the day featuring Matt Billingsley, currently on the Eras Tour with Taylor Swift, marimba virtuoso and international soloist Andre Vinay, Bob Breithaupt, recognized as one of the nation's leaders in percussion education, and Keith Elio, director of percussion at the Interlochen Center for the Arts and consultant for the Avitas Zildjian Company. Ben Lupton from the Music City Mystique will also present a drumline clinic featuring the Victory Drumline, and Jeremy Chapman will present clinics on Irish drumming. Additionally, there will be collegiate and high school education ensemble showcases throughout the day, featuring the Tennessee All-State Percussion Ensemble. You don't want to miss this incredible opportunity to learn from world-class players and educators. Registration is now open. Tickets will also be available at the door, with registration opening at 8:30 a.m. day of event. Credit card only. Final reminder, visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register.
Yeah. Did you get Gadamans yet?
No, but I just interviewed Joe Bergamini, who sort of like co-authored or edited that book.
Nice.
Have you gotten it? Have you been through it?
I've ordered it. I was out of town for the 4th for 2 weeks. I kind of just walked away from drums and music for 2 weeks. I was like, let's have a little reset. You've been playing a lot. Us and Tyler are getting ready to rehearse next week. We got like a festival in Montana next weekend. So I was like, let's walk away for a couple of weeks and reset. So you're just ready and you're pumped to jam.
Cool.
I mean, I am pumped to jam, but just to be rested and ready to do a small little like 5-dayer.
Yeah.
I did, but I ordered it before I left, and since I was gone, I had it sent to my parents' house, and I have not visited yet. I wonder if it's there.
Right. You got to like give yourself incentive to show up at your parents' house.
Yeah. Hey, guys, how you doing? Does anything show up?
Right. You using that washing machine right now?
Exactly. But yeah, totally. Please, Mom, please. But yeah, Steve Gadd, Levon Helm, James Ganson.
Yeah, man.
That's my trio.
I think that's a lot of people's trio.
If I can be those three in one, I'd love that so much.
So this anxiety thing, like, is this something that was caused by drumming and music, or was it something that was kind of always there in you and just sort of like manifested or was exacerbated by your musical career?
I think I was born with it.
Yeah.
For sure. I like looking back on things from childhood, I'm like, that was like the definition of anxiety, like the things you felt. To be perfectly candid, I was really scared of death growing up.
Yeah.
And like, I remember having to talk to somebody and I didn't really like understand it at the time. I was like 5 or 6, I guess.
Right.
And like looking back now and like talking to my parents about it, I was like, oh man, you got so anxious about death that it was like, I think I burned up like a TV as a child because I wouldn't turn it off at night.
Whoa.
Because I couldn't be alone with my thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like different things kept me busy. I think music kept me busy.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't think about too many things at the time. And then kind of coupled with the general like stage terrors, you know, everybody's looking at me, everybody's watching me. Am I playing the right thing? Does this sound good? What do I sound like? You know, are my drums tuned well? And I'm a worrier. And it was just getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, full disclosure, we played in Missoula, Montana. Nothing was wrong. Great day, kind of gray day. I walked around all day, had drank coffee, feeling good, got on the gig, playing pretty well, if I recall. The boys might tell you something different, but I thought it was okay. And then playing through this version of Bus Route. Bus Route's on Country Squire. It's, we played it different at the time. This was before it was recorded. And it was kind of like a fast shuffle, you know, just like a and we were probably cooking it because we cooked everything then. And buddy, I went into a full blown panic attack, like right in the middle of it.
Wow.
Just for no reason. Wow. And like Craig, even the bass player, Craig walks over and he's still playing. He's kind of notices. He's like, "You okay?" I'm like, "No." And we're still just kind of playing. A few measures go by. He looks back over. He's like, "You okay?" And I'm like, "It's like I'm having a panic attack." And like I was shaking, just like couldn't. I was, and I got so nervous I was gonna blow the gig. It was sold out. Like I don't even know, thousands of people in there.
Yeah.
And just like shaking. I'm kind of shaking thinking about it, because it was such a terror.
Yeah.
And it took me like three songs to get out of it.
Wow.
And I was so scared I was going to blow the gig. Wow. Like right there.
How did you get out of it? Did you just sort of like ride it out and white knuckle it and
it
subsided?
Caveman, the sticks, you know? So if you're playing like this, I call caveman wrapping my thumb around it.
And yeah. Just making a fist, like
punching through it and breathing.
Huh?
Deep breaths.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'd be in between a song and I would just kind of sit there. And he'd be talking, I'm breathing, just trying to relax. And then I don't even remember when that gig was now, but like I said, as soon as we got home long enough, I was like, I never want that to happen again.
Right, right. And you said
because that was
terror. You said that sort of like being at home, the stress of COVID and, you know, our aforementioned COVID drinking patterns kind of was that like a breaking point where
pretty much I think everybody was a little nervous when everything happened, and you know, we were I personally have a hard time sitting still. And so just sitting there, I feel like this is terrible. I feel like if I'm not actively doing something, I'm wasting time. You know, so it's like even I'm still a good drummer if I'm sitting in the chair watching Netflix.
Right.
You know, but if I'm not doing something about it, if I'm not constantly working at it, I feel bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I have an internal struggle.
Right.
And that you're not like if you're sitting here watching TV, someone's working.
Right. And I think a lot of drummers have that mentality. And in a lot of cases, it's out of ambition, but it sounds like in your case it was more out of fear, because like you've had so many experiences where you were like on stage just having this internal dialogue like, am I good enough?
Yeah.
So when you're when you're off stage, if you're not like working against that, if you're not doing things constantly that are going to prevent that mentality on stage, that's when you start freaking out.
Yeah, because I want to be prepared, you know. I want no question,
right,
that this is what I'm playing, this is how it's going to feel, this is the tempo or whatever tempo, whoever I'm playing with, because sometimes, you know, I don't count things off all the time. It's just, you know, the singer-songwriter. There's some songs Tyler starts off, you know, and I just got to pick up on that, and whatever he's doing, he's doing. If it's fast, it's fast. If it's slow, it's slow, and that's how it's going to be.
Right.
And, yeah, so always just being ready for whatever tempo, whatever style, whatever, anything. And, you know, at least with practicing, you know, there's a 1,000 million jillion things you can work on at any given moment.
Yeah.
Style, feel, technique, groove, your timing.
Right.
You know, and there's another tree off of every one of those that's what you can do there, you know, and stuff like that. So, but I've stopped all that because it's better for my health.
Yeah.
And basically, I do stay busy with a lot of projects outside of Tyler. A little more narrow focus. Like me and some of the guys have a band called El Dorado. Me and James and Craig from the Food Stamps with our good friend Doug Woodard in town that does all your country western favorites. classics, really, and not bro country, none of that horse shit. And then I play in a band, Ona, in town. Mm-hmm. That's more of a contemporary, like, dance, feel good, rock jams, and doing sessions on the side. But it's like the only thing I care about now is if my timing's good and if my groove is good.
Yep.
And I make it feel appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just kind of worry about that now.
Right. And so, like, how has that changed your experience on stage?
So far, it's good because all I think about is staying relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and knowing that I know the song.
Right.
I'm confident. My confidence has gone way up since, since COVID started. And it's gotten way higher. I'm confident in my abilities. I think it was starting doing sessions too that got my confidence up.
Yeah.
I realized I was like, hey, I'm not terrible at this.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm not as bad as I thought I was.
Yep. I experienced the same thing. Like, you know, recording in my studio here and getting some feedback from people whose opinion I respect and just using my own ears because, like, you know, we do this for a living. We've been doing this a long time. We can trust our ears. And even if it's yourself that you're listening to, if your ears tell you, like, man, this sounds fucking good, you know, unless you're an egomaniacal psychopath, you can usually trust that.
Yeah. It's like, is your head bobbing to your own shit?
Yes. Yeah.
Probably good.
Right.
You know, everybody's going to like it, but you know, whatever.
Is that snare tone giving you stank face? That's your snare tone.
Exactly. Yeah.
You did it.
Exactly. Man, snare tone. Don't even get me started on that.
Yeah.
Bro, I was in a hole like 3 months ago. Could not for the life of me get one damn snare to sound good.
Oh shit!
I probably got 4 or 5 of them at this point.
Right.
Different Ludwig drums.
Yeah.
Shout out Ludwig. Those are my homies.
Right.
And could not get a one of them to sound good. And then damned if I didn't get a drum dial.
Really?
Changed my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah, shout out drum dial.
Talk to me about that because I'm like, I'll be honest. I'm kind of down on the whole drum dial thing. I've never used one, and I'm just of that grumpy old school opinion. It's like you should be able to just do it by ear. Like you don't have
to
get in with a fucking micrometer and all. Just like tune your drum.
Me too.
Okay. So how did the drum dial change your game?
Pure desperation. I was like, I can't do it. I don't know what's going on. I didn't go broke, but I was almost going broke buying different heads. I was like, I've done something. Hmm. I have messed something up. Snare wires, the things that, like the strips, if I went felt or plastic or string, I bought new snare wires, changed gauge. Got different heads back and forth, and nothing sounded good. Hmm. And I was like, this is my last resort. And it wasn't that bad. I realized that things didn't need to be as tight as I was making them.
Mm.
You know, I had my whole thing just, I wasn't doing it right.
Hmm.
And I didn't realize how good things sounded at lower tunings. I always thought that my bottom head on my snare needed to be cranked.
Yep.
Like, I needed to be able to bounce a quarter off this thing.
Right.
And maybe it's just the drums I have. They don't, you know, respond to that as well as, you know, kind of getting it all even across the board, tension wise. But that doesn't mean that each individual lug needs to be the same incremental turn.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I learned with that drum dial is it's going to be on a plane. And it's going to be even across, but they may not be the same tension all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be one whole. Is this making sense?
Yeah. And when you say the same tension all the way around, like, do you mean the same reading on the drum dial or the same number of turns? Okay.
Same reading on the drum dial, because the same reading on the drum dial, if it's all even, not each lug won't necessarily be the same turn.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting, and especially on a snare, I totally disregarded the snare beds.
Yeah.
And I hadn't, like, I was like, damn, I never accounted for that.
Right. So are you tuning,
I think that's,
are you tuning your snare butt, your snare bed lugs lower?
They're the same, but they are just a little lower.
Mm-hmm.
Like once I got all the way around, and especially with the drum dial, you know, you put the drum dial next to the lug and then it gives you the reading. But for the snare beds, you got to go halfway between the snare bed lug and the one next to it. So you're halfway, and then that's how you read the snare bed.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of because where it's like the dip in it, depending on the angle of the dip or how hard that is.
Yeah.
If it's like sharp or more of a U, it's kind of a long, what I think is how I understood it. It's like elongating that tension. So you got to, it's like a trowel of like grout. You're smoothing out on a instead of just like this lug needs to be this.
So you're putting the point between the two snare bed lugs at the same tension as the other actual lugs around the bottom head.
Yes.
Cool. Okay.
Yes. But it, for me, it was really just like figuring out that that snare bed is going to cause major differences. It's not just a round thing.
Right, right.
And for now, the drum dial is getting me a sound that I want. And I'm going to praise it for now.
Go
until,
with it.
Until I can figure it out in my old man ear ways.
Right, right. So have you found that like if you get the same tension on every lug, like the same reading on the drum dial, does that always equate to the same pitch around every point on the head?
Not really. And to go back to using the drum dial, it's right now it's just a starting point.
Yeah.
For me. And it is, it does feel like sometimes that the some of the other lugs are different pitches. If I'm going around with a stick,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it is a little different, but not so much that it's out of tune. It's just kind of giving it more of a body. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And I could be completely wrong.
Yeah.
But this is how I feel is working for me.
Right. Right.
You know,
man, like we don't often get into the weeds about, you know, gear and tuning and drummy shit like this. But, you know, part of my journey in this studio here is realizing that I really didn't know jack shit about tuning before I started like really Same. Putting mics on things. Cause you know, we're tuning. I think you and I have a similar background in that, like it's mostly live, right? Like
yeah.
we've done studio stuff here and there, but mostly live, and tuning for a live gig and just getting through that gig mm-hmm. is just a completely different proposition than tuning in the studio. And you know, yeah. I've spent those same frustrating hours just like trying to find a snare tone or trying to knock down floor tom sustain or trying to mitigate sympathetic buzz from the rack tom. But like with that drum dial, you know, one of my major beefs with it that I never actually have confirmed is that the tension reading that it gives you might not equate to an equal pitch all the way around the head. And that sounds mm-hmm. like it's true, but what I didn't realize was the flip side of that, which is, you know, maybe slight variations in the pitch around the head is not a big deal. Maybe having everything at the exact same tension reading is going to result in a good sound. Just like if you're recording, if you're tuning without the drum dial, you might get everything to the exact same pitch, but that might not equate to the exact same tension, and that could affect your sound also. So it's like it's a double-edged sword, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was honestly, like I said, it was desperation. I really just was out of options. I was just doing everything wrong, I felt like, and I wanted to figure something else out. Maybe I was looking at something different, and getting the readings like that and then realizing some of the tensions were a little different was kind of eye-opening. I was like, well, maybe I've been thinking not everything needs to be so even
mm-hmm.
for the drum to sing
hmm.
as it should,
right?
You know, and especially with, we were talking about same tension, not necessarily giving it that good sound. I had a problem with my bronze Phonic snare, 6.5.
I love those fucking things.
And so good. And, bro, I had everything equal tuning. I was using my ear. I had my little mallet. I was like, everything is the exact same. And I put it back. I turned it back over, put it on a stand, got real comfortable, man, started playing a beat. And I hit that thing and it was like, boing, boing. Like every time I hit it, it was this damn tone, just boing. And I was like, I give up. Bought a drum dial.
Wow. Oh, that's hilarious. And like, man, nothing'll hang a lantern on that boing like a 57 just pointed at your snare drum at the wrong angle, dude, or something. You go back, and that's another thing. Like, you know, you get a drum sounding good in the room and you're like, all right, you get your mic, you get your everything ready to go, and then you listen back to your snare and it's just like,
what the hell is that?
Are we even in the same room? Like, really? Yeah. Really, SM57? Yeah. This is what you hear?
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing too, like all the other tunings, like doing sessions and stuff. What I thought was good tuning isn't necessarily good tuning.
Right, right.
Like once you put a mic on it and listen to it back, it's like, man, do I sound like that all the time?
Yeah.
You know, it's like hearing yourself talk.
And then you come into the whole game of mic placement, right? Because you might not even have to fuck with the tuning at all. If you just find a different spot for that mic, you know, all of a sudden that frequency is gone. God, man, it's black magic. It's fucking voodoo. It's
insanity. I don't even claim to know 1/8 of anything about it.
Man, a lot of us have a long way to go, but it's addictive. It's like golf.
Yeah.
Like you get that one driver shot like down the middle of the fairway and you're like, holy shit, how did I do that? And you're just chasing.
That's my cocaine now. I'm telling you. Yeah. I chase that monkey on my back. Sometimes little mistakes that happen just out of like maybe not remembering a part of a song that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's the magic.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like I live for those moments now. It's
well, yeah, coming
it's
back
the
to
little
your,
mistakes.
Coming back to your onstage experience, I mean, it sounds like you're better able now to like be in the moment, enjoy the moment, have fun, you know, and that confidence in yourself is resulting in just like a more positive, less stressful stage experience.
Yeah, no one's gonna die if I play bad.
Right.
You know, and that's, I mean, as extreme as that sounds, it's kind of what gets me through. I mean, I also just love music again. I don't think I ever hated it, but it's just like, man, life's too short to worry about whether I'm playing super perfect or not. It's all about the music and how things feel, and they make you feel good. Music's supposed to make you feel good, and it's supposed to make you feel sad. It's supposed to make you feel like all kinds of ways. But mostly I enjoy playing drums, and I enjoy like being a bed of all my awesome buddies to lay on with their instruments, you know?
Right. Right.
And that's, I can't explain how that feels. It's amazing. And no amount of worrying if it's perfect or not needs to overtake that feeling.
Right.
You know?
Right. That like that feeling isn't dependent on anything being perfect, because nothing's going to be perfect ever.
Exactly. Exactly. But you get caught up listening to people like Steve Gadd and stuff.
Yeah,
you're like,
man.
Why the hell am I doing this?
But for the same reason he's doing it, because you love music and you want to make it feel good, right?
Exactly.
And none of us can ever make it feel like Gad, but we can still make it feel damn good.
Exactly. Sometimes I feel like trying to imitate people you like helps you find your sound, you know, because you're not going to be that player. You're not going to be Steve Gadd. You're not going to be James Gadsden. No one's going to be Levon Helm.
Right.
And it's like, but you trying to do that, it's just like, oh, there you are.
Yeah.
That's you.
Yep.
You know, and they're happy little mistakes, I guess, or accidents. You kind of slip into, oh, this is how I play because I'm trying to do this, but I'm not this.
Yes.
Because no one else can be that.
Yep. Totally. Totally. So like you mentioned like Gadd and Levon and James Gadsden. I went through this progression of like back in my jazz days and my college days. Like I was like a Peter Erskine clone for a minute, and then I was a Bill Stewart.
I used those sticks for years.
Yeah, me too. And then I was a Bill Stewart clone, and then I was a Keith Carlock clone. You know, my Keith Carlock clone chapter was in like my late 20s, basically. So, you know, by the time I got into my 30s, I feel like I had moved past, you know, just that imitation phase and just like taken flavors from each of those guys and others, but like starting to just move into my own voice. But you're right. Like I wouldn't have found my voice if I hadn't moved through other people's voices first, you know, not many drummers and not many musicians just sort of like have their own voice from an early age. It's so weird how like trying to sound exactly like someone else can just make you sound like you.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Cause some days you wake up and you just want to be Levon Helm, man. It's just, you know, it's hard not to be.
Right.
But,
yeah.
You know, you do the best you can. And like I said, you just remember why you came to the show in it to begin with.
Yeah. Okay. So did you grow up in Huntington, West Virginia?
Born and raised. Yeah.
How big a town is that?
When school's in, I think the last time I checked, there's about 50K people here.
That's small.
50,000, 53,000. Yeah. And I think that's when school's in, there's another 10,000, I think.
What school is that there?
Marshall University. So okay. Have you seen that Matthew McConaughey movie, We Are Marshall?
I know about it, but yeah.
That's the college. That's where I went to school. That's where my good friend Craig went to school, that's in the band, and they have a pretty good, well, they did. I don't know. I've been out of school for a few years now, since 2014. So I don't know how their program's doing now, but especially since COVID. But we were playing every damn day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And doing concerts and combos and festivals and stuff like that. And I was really fortunate to have gone when I went and received awesome teachings and knowledge from really great dudes,
right
that worked there. And so it's not a huge town. It was bigger back in like the 70s. There's a steel mill here.
Oh yeah.
Steel factory. And yeah nothing crazy.
Wow.
Been here my whole life. It's really cheap to live here. I think I'm still here.
I'm sure, man. Yeah.
Five hours from Nashville, I think. Five, six coming back with a time change. Mm-hmm. 2 hours of Lexington, 2:45 to Cincy, 2:30 to Columbus.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, was it ever an option for you to move to Nashville or to try to go to L.A. or, like, what made you stay there?
Man, I toyed with it. Sometimes I feel like I toy with it every year or two. And it was always an option, but I just never pulled the trigger. I guess I always worried about the money aspect, if I could afford to live in a bigger city. Mm-hmm. There was a while where I didn't think I could hang in a big city. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, all that's gone. I don't. You know, I really like the personal touch that this town has in regards to music. Mm-hmm. There's so many good people in this town and so many great musicians in this town that I think that fosters a nice environment. And and James and Craig, who are also in the food stamps, we've played together for years. Mm-hmm. And I love playing with them so much. And there's such a great music scene in town here that I almost have FMS, like afraid of missing something. Mm. With it, you know, I mean, of course, we hit the road and we're gone for weeks and months at a time. But you always come back, kind of see what the scene's doing. We got like one club to play,
yeah,
in town, so it's pretty intimate. I mean, we get some big names come through, like Shooter comes through and plays all the time. Shooter,
yeah,
Jennings,
yeah.
I think Blackstone Cherry's been through, all kinds of people I can't even begin to name. But, you know, and I also just had a lot of fun in my 20s learning and seeing all my friends play good music at the one club in town. And
yeah.
I don't know, man. It feels good. It feels better than a big scene. You know, we're all a little competitive. We all want to outdo each other in a good way, but we also are encouraging everyone.
Yeah.
You know, like I used to go see Ona play in town all the time before I started playing with them. And I remember their first gig and I was immediately like, no bullshit, I was jealous. As soon as they played their first song, I was like, damn, they figured it out. Like they are killing it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wish I could write songs like that, you know? And then they come off stage and we're all hugging and high five and it's like, man, y'all slayed it up there.
Yeah.
You know, and then that feeds into them wanting to be better. And then someone else will see us play and be like, man, y'all killed it. That helps us. And, you know, it's, I don't know if I would trade it to be in a big city scene at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've talked so much about, you know, the scene of a city and the availability of opportunities in a big city.
Yeah.
But I think more and more, you know, between the expense of big cities, like you mentioned, and just the cultivation of like smaller, more local scenes, I think more and more musicians are realizing like, I don't have to live in Nashville or LA or New York, or even like a sort of second tier city like Atlanta or, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, Chicago or whatever. Like you can live in whatever small town you're from or whatever like little city mm-hmm. you've ended up in. Chances are there's going to be like really great musicians, great people, great community. And even if so, like, it, you know, it seems like with the Childers thing, that's sort of like, that's a little lightning in a bottle, because out of your small town, out of your small scene, there's this big gig, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Even if that gig ended tomorrow, it seems like that town is where you belong. That scene is where you found a home.
Yeah, this is where we cultivated all that. All the things that people love about Tyler. Hey, I mean, you can't deny it. Songs are amazing.
Yeah.
So that's different. Everything that people love about, I guess, us playing those songs, it's all started here. This is where we all started learning to play. This is where we are cultivated that vibe. And, mm-hmm. you know, even before all this, we were just doing it regionally, going to Charleston, going to places in Ohio. It's just, you know, Appalachia feels good to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was just up north for 2 weeks for the fourth, and you know, I loved it. It was beautiful. But you know, as soon as I got back here, it was like, this feels good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something about Appalachia that makes me feel good. And I don't think a big city could give me that.
Yeah.
You know, because now none of us live in big cities.
Right. You know? Right.
And
it's like you hear it in the music, like to hear you guys play, and especially to watch you guys play, it feels handmade. It feels like humans are doing it. It feels like something that sort of evolved and grew organically, as opposed to something that was grown in a lab in Nashville or LA.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's what music's supposed to be, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we have a very old school approach to it, for mm-hmm. sure. You know, we're all I mean, we all like the same stuff. A lot of it's old. You know, I listen to a lot of classic country and, you know, Buck Owens and stuff like that. But I mean, we all like artists that are out now too, but, you know, it's very old school. It's very, we don't put on for anybody.
Yeah.
That's for sure. You're going to like it or you don't. Sorry.
Yeah. And I think there's always going to be a place for it. Like, I think some people, you know, sort of, are wringing their hands and bemoaning, like, what's going to become of handmade music without the tracks and without the digital, you know, all the bullshit. But I think there's mm-hmm. always going to be a place for it. Like, you know, people playing music in front of people has been happening for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, dude.
And it's not going anywhere. Like, you know,
no.
technology is going to do its thing. People are going to do their thing with it. Some mm-hmm. of it's going to be cool. Some of it's going to be dog shit. But yeah. just, you know, a band of people playing for a group of people is always going to be a thing. And you guys are killing it.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate that a lot. That means a lot, dude. I've listened to this podcast a bunch, like traveling and stuff. So it's been an honor just to be on here, bro.
Thanks, man. And shout out to Steve, Junk Drummer, for hooking us up. He still will not
tell
me.
He's my boy.
He will not tell me his last name or where he lives, but
I won't let the cat out of the bag, but we're good friends.
I'm guessing it's somewhere near you. I'm guessing it's somewhere in your general vicinity, but
I cannot confirm or deny.
I mean, not that it matters. Who cares? He's doing his thing.
Yeah, no, I've been friends with Steve for a long time. He's definitely been someone I've learned from, you know, advice wise and playing wise and stuff like that. And he's always been a great guy to talk to and bounce stuff off of if I had ever any doubts about something.
He will bounce for sure.
He's candid and I love it. You need a friend like that.
Yeah.
You really do. It's just like, hey man, what about this? And be like, no, it sucks. It's like, thank you. And I know it's not from a place of being evil. It's just, Bubby, I need honesty. Yeah. I will always go to Steve if I need honesty.
Right, right.
So
cool.
Yeah, he's great, man. I can't thank him enough for hooking us up like this.
Wonderful. It was great talking to you, man.
Yeah, likewise, bro. This is fun.
Right on, man. Be well. Safe travels.
Yeah, man.
And
you can do that.
Keep at it. Play pretty.
Yeah, buddy. Gonna try. You do the same, brother. I appreciate you.
Rod Elkins. I could talk to that dude all day. He's out there with Childers. Check him out if you can. Dates are up at tylerchildersmusic.com. Next week, Matthew Krause will be leading a roundtable discussion with six Nashville drummers who spend a lot of time in those honky-tonks down on Lower Broadway. We've mentioned that scene a lot and all the pros and cons that come with it. It's probably the most ubiquitous type of gig in Nashville, and Matt is going to get the perspective of some people with boots on the ground down there. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, get vaxxed. For the love of God, get vaxxed. And thanks for listening. Cheers.